the National Archives podcast series. John Reginald Christie, A Study in Sources, The National Archives and Beyond, presented by Dr. Jonathan Oates.
As some of you will probably know, 2013 is the 60th anniversary of the execution of John Christie for the murder of his wife. But I won't be talking about the story in great detail, but I'll be talking more about the sources for the history of the case in more detail. Now, I said I wouldn't actually talk about the crimes in any great detail, but I'll just talk for 5 minutes, a brief summary of John Christie's life and crimes, just to set the scene. Well, Christie was born in 1899 in Halifax. His youth was fairly nondescript, but he may well have picked up an inferiority complex in his younger years. In 1916, he joined the army and was wounded by poison gas in 1918. In 1920, he married Ethel Simpson in Halifax, but in 1921, working as a postman, he committed his first offence, in which he stole various postal orders and cheques. He was sent to Manchester Prison with a sentence of 3 months. In 1923, he committed another offence involving money, but in this time, he was only given a 12-month probation period. In the same year, he moved down to London by himself, and in the following year, 1924, he committed his third known crime in Uxbridge, a case of stealing, again, a bicycle and various other items. He was sentenced for 9 months in prison. In 1929, he committed another crime. He attacked the woman he was living with, Mrs. Maud Coles, in Battersea, with a cricket bat, and he was sentenced to 6 months in prison. In 1933, he committed another offence, again in the Uxbridge district, stealing a motor car, where he was sentenced for another 3 months in prison. All this time, he'd been moving from place to place in London, mostly working as a lorry or van driver. Although he also worked in a cinema, he worked for the Royal Air Force, and he worked as an electrician. In 1934, he was reunited with his wife Ethel, who came down from Sheffield, and in 1937 they began to live at 10 Rillington Place, Notting Hill. Now, as said, he'd committed 5 criminal offences. He was outwardly respectable and apparently hard working, employed in a cinema again, this time in Hammersmith, in the years before World War II. In 1939, he became a War Reserve Constable for the Metropolitan Police, commended on 2 occasions, but it was during this period he committed his first murder. That was in 1943 of an Austrian refugee by the name Ruth Furst, who he'd invited back to his house. He was living on the ground floors in Rillington Place. At a time, of course, when his wife was absent, He had sexual intercourse with her, and he strangled her before putting her body eventually in the back garden. In 1944, having managed to escape any suspicion of any foul deed, he committed his second murder, this time of Muriel Eady, who was a woman who he worked with. By this time, Christie had left the police and was working in a radio factory in Acton. He'd invited Muriel Eady back to his house, where again, same routine as with Ruth Furst, and her corpse ended up in the garden. No one suspected that these women had been murdered or that Christie had anything to do with it. After the war, he began to work once again for the post office, mainly in Kew, and in 1950, he was the key prosecution witness in the murder case of in which Timothy Evans was charged with the murder of his daughter Geraldine. This murder had taken place in the same house where Christie lived. Evans was found guilty and hanged. In 1952, Christie then strangled his wife and put her body under the floorboards once again. This was in the living room. In January to March 1953, he killed 3 more women. Firstly, Kathleen Maloney. Secondly, Rita Nelson, and thirdly, and finally, Hectorina McLennan. All of them were fairly young women, and in all cases, he'd inveigled them back to his house with various promises. He had gassed them to render them unconscious. He had sexual intercourse with them. He strangled them. But in these cases, he put them, the bodies, in an alcove in the kitchen and wallpapered it over. few weeks after the last murder, he left the premises, and a few days later, a new tenant, Mr. Beresford Brown, discovered a corpse in the kitchen. He contacted the police. The police soon found several corpses in the house. A large-scale manhunt occurred, and Christie was eventually arrested just near Putney Bridge. He was tried in June 1953 for the murder of his wife. He pleaded guilty but insane, but the court found him guilty but sane, so he was sentenced to hang. He was hanged on the 15th of July 1953 at Pentonville Prison. There's been quite a lot of controversy over the case as to whether Christie killed the Evans baby and Beryl Evans, Timothy Evans's wife. There's been various judicial reviews subsequently. Now, the points of this talk will mainly consider how to research the life and crimes of a serial killer, how to find out about the lives as well as the deaths of his victims, and also information about the nature of police and judicial investigations. There's two things that we need to consider before undertaking any research of this kind. The first one is you must try your utmost to shut out of your minds everything you have read or heard or even thought about the case or about Christie himself. You must approach the matter, so far as you possibly can, with an open mind. As our old English legal phrase puts it, you must hearken to the evidence. And that was advice that was given to the jury at Christie's trial by Lionald Heald, who was Attorney General, and he led the prosecution case against Christie. So basically what he's saying is everything in your mind already ought to be disregarded before you actually examine the evidence. The other thing to bear in mind is one fact which is not in dispute and which has hampered all efforts to find the truth is that both Evans and Christie were liars. They lied about each other, they lied about themselves. And that's a quotation from Judge Daniel Brabin in 1966 when he compiled the Brabin Inquiry, which was an inquiry which took place to determine whether Evans was innocent of murder or not. Now, the question is, how do we find out about anything? Well, there are several obvious sources that would commend themselves to most people. There's the internet, of course, in recent years seen as the source of all, if not most, information. Then there's film and TV, and it's argued, of course, that most people get their history from film and TV rather than the latest volume of the English Historical Review. An example is that the film Ten Willington Place has had about 63 Amazon reviews, but the best book on the topic about Christie has only had 14 reviews. So a lot more people use film and TV for information than books. But books, of course, are a very important source of information too. And until the internet arrived, probably the most often used source of information about most things. Finally, of course, there's word of mouth. You can talk to people who were there at the time or who have a knowledge on the topic. There are other sources as well, and we'll come to those later, but we'll first try and discuss the obvious sources which most people, probably including myself, would have a look at if we were interested, even on a casual basis, about a particular topic. Well, the internet, to begin with, only a click of a button away. You can type in John Christie or Willington Place. You've got lots and lots of hits. Wikipedia is the common man's encyclopedia, widely trusted by lots of people. And indeed, there is a site, there's a Wikipedia entry on John Christie. However, it is heavily based on one or two books, which we'll come to later, neither which I would suggest are particularly reliable. But Wikipedia does not accept entries from anything which has not been published. So if you found a very interesting entry in an archived document, Wikipedia would not accept this sort of information, and somebody would no doubt scrub it off. But however, a more reliable site is www.10willingtonplace.co.uk, which is basically a site which explains where the site of Willington Place is now. As probably most of you know, Willington Place was demolished in 1970s as part of slum clearance in Notting Hill, and it was replaced by a set of houses called Bartle Road, which do not correspond exactly with the site of the Old Willington Place. This website goes into great detail about how to find the exact location. It has lots of photographs, it has book reviews, it has information about the case. It also has information about the commonly held myths of the case, which we can talk about later. The Christie section of Ripper Forum is also useful. Now, this forum is primarily, as you can guess, about Jack the Ripper. But there is a big subsection about Christie where people discuss various aspects of the case. Mainly, it's to and fro in between Evans was innocent. No, he wasn't. Evans was guilty. Oh, yes, he was. And that becomes very circular. But there are interesting bits and pieces of information on that website, as well as this rather circular argument. And then, of course, there's lots of websites about John Christie or London crimes or serial murders, lots of them. But they tend to be fairly brief, just have a couple of pages of information, not tremendously reliable or informative, in my opinion. The film. Now, most people will have seen the film Ten Willington Place, which was produced in 1970, starred Richard Attenborough as Christie, John Hurt as Evans, produced by Richard Fleischer, screenplay by Clive Exton, also well known for producing such crime dramas such as Agatha Christie's Poirot and Dick Barton. The advisor was Ludovic Kennedy, who we'll come to a bit later on. Now, it's a very well-acted film. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Attenborough and Hurt are excellent, as you'd expect. The settings are also wonderful, and if that's the right word, for such a seedy sort of post-war sort of milieu. But the actual street in which the crimes took place in, it was used just before demolition, so that gives it a great air of authenticity. However, the film is very unfactual. There's lots and lots of various factual errors, which I can talk at great length. Basically, what the film isn't, only it says this is a true story at the beginning, it's actually more of a propaganda film, sort of anti-capital punishment film, rather than a serious attempt to actually show what happened or what might have happened. TV. Well, there's a couple of years ago, a chap called Fred Dynage, who was an expert on the Cray twins. He brought out a series of TV films about various notorious criminals, one being John Christie, others, Haig, and Dennis Nilsen, various others. And it featured interviews, this is the Christie one, with Professor David Wilson, an academic from Birmingham University, and Edward Marston, who's a well-known crime novelist and author of a book about Christie, and former Police Sergeant Trevelyan, who had various reminiscences. But unfortunately, it's not particularly wonderful. The aims of the programme, which are laid out by Dynage early on, don't seem to be followed up very much. It also seems to be undecided whether Evans was innocent or not, initially saying, oh yes, he definitely was, and then saying, well, he might not have been. And it's not particularly wonderful as regards fact. But you can buy these on DVD, on Amazon and eBay and so forth. The Notorious Killers, which is 45 minutes long, and the rather lengthier Ten Willington Place film. Books. Well, books obviously are a key source of information. And there's four types of books. The first type are primary material. That's material which was written by people who were involved in the case or people who were involved very shortly afterwards. Judge Brabin's Willington Place is the summary of his findings in 1966 over the Evans and Christie responsibility for the deaths of Beryl and Geraldine Evans. Dr. Francis Camp, his book is about a forensic examination of the corpses found in Willington Place and the skeletons. Now, Dr. Camps was the pathologist who was used by the police in this case. He also, ironically, performed the post-mortems on John Christie and a few years before John Haig. It's a very scientific book. He goes into great detail about bones and blood. There's various pictures which aren't always for faint-hearted. Mr. Maxwell's book, the first book on the topic, which was written before Christie was even hanged, is by a journalist, and he has a step-by-step investigation about the case and the trial which took place at the end. Then there's Tennyson Jesse, who wrote a volume in a series called Great British Trials, which are a series of volumes published until the late 1950s of various famous trials from Mary Queen of Scots to Evans and Christie are some of the last ones. And basically, it's a word-for-word examine. It's a word-for-word duplication of everything that was said at those two trials. So it's a highly valuable document, and anyone seriously interested in the case ought to try and see this book or any of the three books in this series. And then we have our more well-known type of books, the books that you buy in a shop, which will give you a narrative history of the case. These books, apart from the first one, and also the last one, were all published before the archives at the National Archives were made available. So perhaps we ought to go easy on them a little bit, because the evidence used by Michael Eddowes, Rupert Furneaux and Ludovic Kennedy is nowhere near as great as it is now. But on the other hand, these three gentlemen were all able to speak to people who were around at the time. These books, in fact, all these books, concentrate on the fact, did Evans or did Christie kill Beryl or Geraldine Evans? And different books will argue different things. Rupert Furneaux's book, incidentally, argues that, rather peculiarly, that Evans killed his wife, but Christie killed his daughter. But the other books argue differently, often in quite strong terms. And some of these books, or at least one or two of them, certainly, are in fact very biased. And sometimes the authors, even though they never met Christie or Evans, often tell you what happened in their mind, which is pretty amazing, I think. The third type of books are books which are not primarily about the case, but do have important chapters in them. The first is Professor Simpson's 40 Years of Murder. Well, he was a pathologist, also involved in the Christie and Evans case. He has a very interesting chapter on that case. It's strongly recommended. Lolly Lefebvre was the journalist. She had been Dr. Simpson's assistant in the 1940s, but her book, 1958, Murder of a Difference, examines in great detail the cases of both Christie and also the case of John Haig as well. Conrad Phillips, a journalist and writer, wrote Murderer's Moon, and that's a study of four post-war murderers, Heath, Haig, Chesney, and of course Christie. And more recently, and I would argue rather less usefully, is Neil Root's book Frenzy, which is about the post-war murderers Heath, Haig, and Christie. And although Root did have access, if he wanted to the files at the National Archives, unfortunately, he decided to choose not to, so it's not tremendously original. Finally, there are novels, and there's three novels which have a lot about this case. The first and least well-known, I would argue the best, is John Newton Chancer's book, The Crimes of Rillington Place, A Reconstruction. And this sticks to the facts, but does have some interpretation as well in the form of dialogue between Evans and his wife. Ruth Rendell's book, recently televised last year, 13 Steps Down, takes place about 50 years after the murders, but it's takes place in Notting Hill, and the central character is a man who has a weird obsession with Christie. And finally, Laura Wilson's book, A Capital Crime, which is a fictionalisation of the Evans and Christie case, but changes all the names and changes a few of the facts. And interestingly enough, it has a rather open-ended conclusion, whereas most books at the end will tell you firmly one thing or another. Laura Wilson is, I think, interestingly, fairly open-ended about the final verdict. Now, the problem is with a lot of these books is that because most of them did not have access to the National Archives files, or the myriad of other information elsewhere, or chose not to use it, they often tend to repeat myths, which occur in almost every single book. And these myths include things like Christie stole a car from a priest, and there's no evidence for that. The original newspaper about the trial referred to it being stolen from his secular employer. Or another fact, Christie arrived at Tenrington Place in 1938. Well, the electoral registers in Kensington Library show he was there by the latest, 1937, and so forth and so on. So as always with historical research, it's useful to read the books, but not to take anything that they say has been accurate. So we'll now come across on to the meat of the matter, the archives at the National Archives, and there's a lot of them. There's probably more archives about this case and its ramifications, and probably, and I'm sure someone can put me right if I'm wrong, than any other murder case at all. Now, these files are taken from various departments of state, Metropolitan Police Force, the Home Office, the Department of a Public Prosecutor, the Prison Commission, the Cabinet, pensions files, and Treasury solicitors. Now, these files often have a lot of information in which is duplicated in other files, because at the time, departments were making copies of various correspondence and files and passing them around. So it's important, if you're seriously interested in obviously going through all of these, but you will find a lot of duplication. But these files are very, very important because they contain all the witness statements, of which there were many, which were taken at the time. So you've got witness statements by the neighbours of the Christies in Rillington Place, and a good many of those they are as well. You've got statements by people who used to know the Christies of Evans's in earlier lifetimes. For example, one is a letter by an ex-boyfriend of Ethel Christie, who tells us that, contrary to popular opinion, Ethel Christie was not permanently a plump, rather stupid woman, but when she was young, she was rather attractive and intelligent. And there's lots of other information that you can find out. You can find out a lot about Christie's victims, about the details of the lives of Ruth First, for example, and Rita Nelson, and all the other victims. Now, these files also give clues to other information. So, for example, several of Christie's victims had previous criminal records, and these files, although not detailing the records, do tell you when it happened and when, which then enables you to look elsewhere, for example, in newspapers and so forth, to gain more information. Now, the cabinet files are files mainly from the judicial inquiries into the alleged or real miscarriage of justice in the Evans business. And one of these, and these files include word-by-word accounts of all the witnesses that were brought forward during those investigations. And this produced a lot of new information, including, for example, statements by policemen who knew Christie during his time in the police. And also, in cab 43/21 is Christie's original statement that he made for the journalists who reproduced it later in the Sunday Pictorial. So there's a great deal of information in the National Archives. Now, originally, all this was closed for 75 years after the date of creation. But fortunately, in about 1992 or 3, it was made available due to freedom of information legislation, etc. So all this is now available, and as I said, it does contain a huge amount of very valuable information that is strongly recommended. It also includes pictures. Now, some of the pictures are very unpleasant to see. For example, there's close-ups of faces of murder victims, which is pretty grim. Now, the National Archives, as important as it is for the study of this case, in fact, indispensable, there are other archives elsewhere as well. First of all, there's the London Metropolitan Archives, Clerkenwell, and that's important because it has the prison registers and court registers, which for various London prisons and London courts. They include registers for prisons such as Wandsworth, Wormwood and Holloway. Now, Christie was incarcerated in Wandsworth for all three of his fairly minor offences in the 20s and 30s, so you'll find entries referring to himself here. The Holloway registers have one or two entries for Kathleen Maloney for being drunk and disorderly and various other minor offences in the late 40s and early 50s. The court registers include registers for the magistrates' courts in London, such as the South West London Magistrates' Court, which Christie was taken before in 1929, and also they have ones for Uxbridge Court and various other courts, for example, Bow Street and Marlborough Magistrates' Courts, where Ruth First had to attend because she was classified as an enemy alien, being Austrian, of course, and hadn't been telling the police where she'd moved to. So these registers of both the courts and the prisons give interesting information about Christie and some of his victims. Now, Christie was employed by the Post Office in 1921 and again in 1946-1950. The Post Office staff records are held at the GPO archives, which are not too far away from the London Metropolitan Archives. And these record Christie's brief details about his service in the post office. It's ironic to note that the investigating officer into Christie's misdemeanours at the post office on one occasion had the surname Death. Now, Christie, as I said, he originated from Yorkshire, and the various parts of the West Yorkshire Archive Service have information about the Petty Sessions, Halifax, and also they have police records as well, which relate to Christie's early offences. Kensington Library have the electoral registers for Kensington, which I've previously mentioned. They also have plans, maps, and rate books, which shows that Rillington Place was first rated, and it first was in existence and people were living there, in about 1869. West Yorkshire Archive Service also has other material, parish records, and records for employment at the mill, in which Christie's father worked, and it's sometimes alleged Christie worked. Well, there's no evidence that Christie ever worked there. Now, if we come to newspapers. Now, newspapers are an interesting source of information, sometimes very useful, but sometimes very unreliable. They tend, in my opinion, to be better when they're reporting things which have happened in the very recent past, but not, perhaps, I would suggest, when they're talking about things which happened 20, 30, 40 years ago on the whole. Now, if we take the national newspapers first. Now, the Christie case was a case of wife murder, but, of course, it was a lot more than that. It was a serial killing case, and in the 1950s, these were pretty unusual. And therefore, for several months in 1953, from the time of the discovery of Christie's victims to his execution in July, the newspapers were full of the Christie case. Some newspapers, such as the Sunday Pictorial, the News of the World, the Daily Mirror, etc., had a great deal of information on the front page with lots and lots of pictures throughout. Other newspapers, such as the Times, were a bit more discreet and had small columns tucked away inside. But during the time of the trial, Christie was big news. In 1965, the Christie case came up again, because this was the time when Judge Brabin had been summoned to reinvestigate the case. So some newspapers had a great deal of information in 1965, 1966, about all the new evidence that was found at the time. Now, the Sunday Pictorial is particularly interesting because it was the newspaper which got the scoop on Christie. It was the paper's journalist, Mr. Harry Proctor, also from Yorkshire, who managed to persuade Christie to give his life story, or a version of it, to the newspaper to publish after the trial, in return for the newspaper paying Christie's defence. This was quite a common plot at the time. A few years before, the News of the World had paid for the defence of Haig in return for his life story to be published in their newspapers. So the Sunday Pictorial was the first newspaper to have Christie's story as told to Harry Proctor published. Other newspapers obviously had a lot of information at the time as well. And after Christie's trial, when he was found guilty, newspapers were allowed to publish virtually almost anything they wanted about him because he could hardly sue them for libel. And unfortunately, this did bring about a lot of incorrect information coming out in newspapers. I regret to say that the Daily Telegraph was stating a story about Christie having stolen from a Catholic priest in Uxbridge, which is something, as I said, is a myth that's been picked up by writers ever since, but there isn't a grain of truth in it. An extract from the Times: three women found dead in flat. So a fairly nondescript sort of little article in the Times, whereas other newspapers would blazon it away on the front page. Now, local newspapers are also important for two reasons. Firstly, local newspapers in the past, and a few do now, had a lot of national news in them as well. So the Halifax newspapers in 1953, as well as the newspapers of many other counties and towns, also had a lot to say about Christie. But more importantly, I think, the local newspapers have a single source of information about Christie and some of his victims in previous years. Because before 1953, hardly anyone had heard of John Christie, Rita Nelson, or any of the victims. But that's not to say that none of these people had not appeared in the press in the past. They had. Because one of the best ways of getting yourself in the local newspaper in the past, and I'm sure now, is to commit a crime. It may be a minor crime, and often is. In fact, most crimes reported in newspapers, at local newspapers, are minor, relatively speaking. So Christie appears in the Halifax Guardian and in the Halifax Courier in 1921 and 1923, and it's in those newspapers which give the most complete account of his trial for theft from the post office and in later times. And likewise, the Middlesex Advertiser and Middlesex County Times in 1924 and 1933 gave quite detailed accounts of his thefts in and around Uxbridge. Likewise, the South London papers in 29 give accounts of his attack on Maud Curls in 1929. Now, all these local newspapers are really important to use because they contradict many of the myths that have been created since. For example, Ludovic Kennedy, and he's not the only one, in his book, Temington Place, states confidently that Christie was living with a prostitute in 1929 who he attacked with a cricket bat. Well, the newspaper reports certainly make no reference to the victim's occupation, but since it's stated that she worked in the daytime, it seems unlikely she's a prostitute. Since Christie, who the court certainly wanted to throw the book at, there's no reference to him living off immoral earnings, so it seems highly unlikely that this woman was a prostitute at all. And all this information has been available, of course, since the newspaper was published. There's no excuse for Ludovic Kennedy and Kerr not to have looked up these things up. Anyway, all these are important sources, but also they're important for some of the previous stories about some of Christie's victims. Rita Nelson, who used to live in Belfast, was convicted for theft in 1946, and there's an article about her crime in the Belfast Telegraph, which you can see at the newspaper library in Colindale. And likewise, in the Southampton Press, there's lots of little articles about Kathleen Maloney's various scrapes with the law for being drunk and disorderly, for prostitution, for abusing policemen and various other things. And you can find out about her in these. But you can only really do so because you've already been to the National Archives and you've seen their record sheets, which gives you the date and the place of their relatively minor offences. Because looking through newspapers, unless they've been digitalised, and of course increasingly large numbers of newspapers are being digitalised and are available by subscription or free of charge at the British Library, it's difficult to pick up these names. The Kensington newspapers of both 1949, 1950, 1953 inevitably had a lot to say about Evans and Christie because, of course, Notting Hill is in Kensington. For example, you get snippets of information you don't find elsewhere. So in 1953, local newspapers interviewed various neighbours of Christie and even a local Labour councillor who, interestingly enough, all had fairly good things to say about him. You also learn Christie's politics as well. So there's a lot of information in local newspapers, if you know where to look, as well as the national newspapers. Now, the late, great Professor W.G. Hoskins of Leicester University once observed that even if all the record offices and libraries in the world had been disbanded and the collections all destroyed, the local historian still has sources of information available if he uses his feet and his eyes. Now, clearly, many buildings involved in the Christie case have now been demolished. Most famously, of course, Rillington Place, or Ruston Close, as it was renamed in 1954, was demolished in the 1970s. But there's other buildings in Notting Hill which were associated with the case, such as 11 St Mark's Road, which is where the Evans family lived in the late 1940s. That is no longer in existence. There's a house in Clarendon Road, where the Christies briefly lived in the 30s. No longer in existence. But there are many houses and buildings which have associated with the case which still survive. So, for example, Oxford Gardens in Notting Hill, not far from the Ladbroke Grove tube station, was home at different times to both Ruth First in the 1940s and to Ethel and John Christie in the 1930s. The Kensington Park Hotel is not the most salubrious of public houses, but it still survives on Ladbroke Grove, and that was the local pub for Timothy Evans. There's also pubs on Praed Street, which is now rather more upmarket than it was in 1953, which still survive, and the Fountain Pub, which was once the haunt of Kathleen Maloney and lots of other prostitutes and American servicemen, who obviously are no longer evident there now, is still in existence. So it is possible to actually see some of these sites which still exist. And certainly if you walk around the Notting Hill and Ladbroke Grove area, although clearly a lot has changed in the last 60 years, I think if you look up at some of the houses, especially those around the tube station, I think it gives you, I think, a little bit of an idea of the place about 60 or 70 years ago, somewhat grimy and down at heel, even though there has been some gentrification in that district. It's of course important to remember that if you are looking around buildings and houses, it's important to remember to respect the privacy of the residents. Certainly in 1953, the local residents of Willington Place were very annoyed when there were busloads of tourists actually went down to have a look at the street. And there's an anecdote about a Welsh couple, ironically enough perhaps, who went to see 10 Willington Place shortly after Christie's trial. And the chap said, oh, well, we're in London on our honeymoon, and this is the highlight. Now, of course, apart from all the sources I've talked about, books, archives, newspapers and so forth, there are other miscellaneous sources which all's worth remembering to use. Now, if you're writing a biography about a particular individual, it's always important to remember that these people are people, and that genealogical sources are not just for family historians. And there's a great deal of genealogical sources which are useful for investigating the history of anyone alive or dead who lived in the UK at some time. Perhaps most importantly are the census returns, which of course are available up to 1911. So you can see John Christie on the census for 1901 and 1911, likewise Ethel Christie or Ethel Simpson, as she was then called. You can also order birth certificates, death certificates, and so forth, which pinpoint the dates when people were born. Now, in one of the opening pages of one of the well-known books on the Christie case, it states confidently, Christie was born on the 8th of April, 1898. Well, if that author troubled himself to look at a birth certificate, he'd realise it's actually 1899. Only it has to be said that Christie, on occasion, didn't seem to know which year he was born. And for example, when he joined the Royal Air Force in 1923, he said he thought he was born on the 8th of April, 1896. Electoral registers are useful for tracking people down, and again, a lot of electoral registers are now searchable online, and certainly some of the ones for Kensington can be searched online. For example, you can search in the 1930s about the whereabouts of the family of Beryl Evans, who was Beryl Fawley, and you can see how her family moved around various different addresses in South London in the 1930s. Likewise, you can find all the other residents of the house Tenmington Place were in the 1940s and 1950s, assuming, of course, that people are 21 or over. So you won't ever see Beryl Evans on an electoral register because she was never 21. Military records are useful too. As I said, Christie was in the army in the First World War. You can see his pension record, which gives you interesting information about his military service. And there's wills. Now, Christie, of course, and most of his victims were very, very impoverished people, didn't make wills. But you can see the will, for example, of Christie's father and grandfather. Oral history and reminiscences are another good source of information, especially from people who were around at the time. Christie's Royal Air Force record, another sort of random record. This was from the Royal Air Force disclosures. Unfortunately, as he joined the Royal Air Force in 1923, his records are still at the Ministry of Defence, so you've got to pay to see them. There's various miscellaneous information. Unfortunately, just after I'd finished writing this book, someone sent me an email and various attachments with copies of letters written by Ethel Christie. Now, Ethel Christie's letters were discovered in an attic in Sheffield in the late 1990s. And unfortunately, well, these presumably were sold to a private dealer, because as far as I know, they are not available for public access in any public repository. But I've seen a few of them, and although they are fairly humdrum, ordinary letters saying, you know, it's raining, or I'd like to see you, or we're having problems with our neighbour sort of thing. There are interesting snippets of information. For example, this one talks about John Christie having burnt his suit on a fire and therefore had to buy a new one. And this was causing Ethel and John a bit of financial embarrassment because they didn't have much money and they had to scrape around to actually find some money to buy him a new suit. So lots of interesting little comments about life at the time, but unfortunately very few I have seen don't have anything of dramatic importance. But if the others were found and made available, they might be interesting. But I suspect it would cast more information about the lives of the Christies and their neighbours rather than Ethel writing to her sister, I think John's a murderer or whatever. To conclude, I think as with all historical research, you need to think laterally. You need to pursue numerous avenues of inquiry. Don't think that everything is in one place. There's a lot of information in the National Archive, for instance, but there's also information elsewhere. So you do need to travel to other places and look through as much as you can in order to gain the most information that is available. Thirdly, do not trust anything you see written down in a book. Perhaps if it's heavily footnoted, you can then check that the author is correct. But if it's not footnoted, I would take it for something that may or may not be true, but shouldn't be taken for granted. I said check everything against primary sources. Now, primary sources, of course, are very important, but primary sources often conflict with each other. So you'll need to decide which you think is more likely to be correct. Make a note of all information you've gained from any source, partly because if you want to publish something, if you have information about footnotes, it's pretty worthless. But also, even if you're not, it's useful to put it down, because if you want to recommend it to someone else, or if you want to refer back to it, or if you are thinking of writing something and you've got lots of information but you haven't put down where you found it from, you might end up going to the same place on more than one occasion and wasting precious time. And finally, be prepared to have all your preconceptions challenged. You may well think something because, say, you've seen the film or you've read a book on the topic, but the archival material and all the sources I've read will suggest other alternative solutions, other possibilities, other avenues of thought you may not have occurred to. So be prepared to think and be prepared to alter your initial mindset. Thank you.
This talk was recorded on the 5th of September 2013 at the National Archives, Kew. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.